Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about physical therapy on the program today and start the show by talking about rotator cuff tears. Back with us, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to have you back.
It's awesome to be here on a gorgeous Wisconsin day.
It is indeed. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, our other guest. And Jill, great to see you again.
It is fabulous to be here. Thanks, Larry.
So as we talk with Lori and Jill, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Do you need advice on managing shoulder pain, for example? Do you think you have a rotator cuff problem, other physical therapy issue? Join the conversation. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jill, let's start with you. We've all probably heard about rotator cuff tears, but maybe let's go to the basics. What exactly is the rotator cuff?
Well, that's a great question. So the rotator cuff is comprised of four very small yet very important muscles in your shoulder joint. And basically what the job of the cuff muscles is to do is to kind of steer the humerus or kind of keep the ball in the socket and keep it placed appropriately in the socket. So they're kind of the fine tuners, if you will, of the shoulder. And so because of that, every time we move our arm, change positions, reach to get something out of the cupboard, the rotator cuff has to fire and be on and make sure that the ball, the humeral head, is kind of seated appropriately or situated appropriately in the glenoid or the socket. So they're really, even though they're small, they're very mighty and they're somewhat of a workhorse because they're always the positioners to keep the ball in the socket.
And with three, I would expect you could have different, or four. I expect you could have different types of tears depending which muscle.
Absolutely. So they all have somewhat of a unique role or responsibility with that movement. However, the two that kind of take the brunt of it, if you will, are the supraspinatus and the infraspinatus. And the supraspinatus is on top. And so by kind of geographic location, the supraspinatus is at risk of injury because he can become pinched with overhead activity. And the infraspinatus's neighbor is also at risk just because he does so much. He's a muscle that does a lot of external rotation, and he's one of two that can do it. So we put a lot of load and a lot of pressure on those muscles, and they can, just like the meniscus, even though the meniscus is not a muscle that contracts, they can kind of get degenerative changes and kind of wear out over time.
Yeah, and so is it wear, or how do we usually get a tear? Is it, I assume, probably some wear? Lori, do you want to jump in?
Sure. There are several different ways you can injure your rotator cuff. Many of them, as we age, become degenerative wear and tear, particularly for people who work with their arms overhead or people who do a lot of overhead or arm activities such as swinging a hammer. But we see it a lot in our workers who work overhead, whether it's doing lighting, electrical, painting, anything like that, or, holding objects overhead. Or the other important thing to think about, particularly with the rotator cuff, is we think of it as creating rotation. And several of the muscles of those four rotator cuff muscles do rotate, but they also stabilize. So the rotator cuff is super important, as Jill said, in stabilizing the humeral head. And we see that in things like a bench press. So you think about the activity of pressing or pushing. People who push things all day long get wear and tear injuries. people who are heavy weightlifters who appear to be very strong injure their rotator cuff because the muscles that do the pushing, like your pectorals and your lats, are so much bigger that as you increase your workload, you overpower the rotator cuff. Then the other time you get the acute tear is typically from a fall. So for an older person who falls and lands on an outstretched arm, they're likely to tear their rotator cuff. So that would be the acute tear. So we see them in all flavors.
And do you know right away when you get one? Or, I mean, what are the symptoms
That's a great question and a great point. There are people who have degenerative tears, just kind of wear and tear, that can have, for example, torn up to 50% of their supraspinatus and can still function just fine. So there are people who are walking around with cuff tears. Between all of us sitting in the room, one of us probably has a degenerative cuff tear, but we're asymptomatic because we've compensated, we've learned how to manage it over time. At some point, it may become symptomatic, where people have problems with it. And there are other times when people have actually what we call full thickness tears, where they completely tear all the way through the muscle. And that can cause some significant functional limitations with difficulty reaching overhead, things like that. So those people who have what I would call symptomatic full thickness tears are people who will definitely seek access in the healthcare system.
Yeah, you'd probably know that right away, that right. You need some treatment there. What right. But these minor ones, I mean, when do you know you need treatment? I guess you certainly would know it in the circumstance you just described, but...
Well, that's a really great question. So we will see individuals in their 50s and 60s and 70s who come in with this shoulder pain. And many times their complaints are difficulty with reaching overhead. Night pain is very common in people with rotator cuff pathology. And they'll come in and they may have done an activity such as, emptying their wheelbarrow full of mulch this weekend, because I saw a lot of people doing that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden there was something that kind of threw them, as Lori would say, out of homeostasis. And so those people will come in. And then the question is, well, do they have a little degenerative tear that was pre-existing? Or is this just simple impingement syndrome? And those people are very difficult to officially diagnose. Yet, regardless of the status of their rotator cuff, initially the care probably isn't going to change. Would you agree, Lori?
I would agree. And you don't always need imaging right away, because unless you're certain you're going to go on to surgery, we're going to treat it conservatively. There's not a lot of space for your rotator cuff in your shoulder. So Jill has mentioned the word impingement, and impingement is sort of somewhere along that continuum of rotator cuff pathology. So between the ball and the sort of roof made by the end of your, well, by your acromion, by the end of your clavicle, there's not much space for your rotator cuff tendon, the long head of your biceps tendon, and a bursa. So if you go out and you have a little bit of fraying of that tendon, then you go out and you unload that giant wheelbarrow full of mulch, as Jill mentioned, and you flare up, for example, the subacromial bursa, it's going to put pressure on the tendon. You're going to have the same kind of symptoms as someone who has torn their rotator cuff. But in the absence of a fall or some acute injury, chances are you didn't tear it, but you inflamed it and irritated it. And then we would treat that conservatively with some physical therapy. And we're going to try to get the shoulder to calm down, to decrease the inflammation, restore the strength to the rotator cuff muscles and the long head of the biceps, and so on.
So heat, cold, what treatments, or what are kind of the basic ones?
Yep. So in an acute situation, for example, the individual who scooped mulch all weekend and has this kind of acute sore shoulder, using ice initially is probably a very good strategy. And again, when we're talking about that demographic of individuals, let's say just between the ages of 50 and 70, that population is also at high risk for something we call a frozen shoulder. So we want the patient to move their arm, but go, as I like to say, up to, but not through the point of pain. So we want to keep it moving, but we're not going to get aggressive and push too hard and kind of push into that pinching type of pain that we had discussed earlier. And if your pain isn't subsiding in a week or so, it's probably time to seek medical care to make sure you're appropriately managed. And again, it would be conservative care, but to really design a good exercise or rehabilitation program for you. One of the things that we know is really important with patients with rotator cuff pathology is we've been talking about the rotator cuff so much, but what's really important is the T or the glenoid or their shoulder blade, how that's positioned or seated. And so a lot of rehabilitation will actually start with focusing on the shoulder blade or the scapula and making sure that it has adequate mobility and strength. So it can be in a good place to always receive the humeral head.
Well, you two are always kind of not against surgery, but it's sort of a last resort kind of thing. And we do hear rotator cuff surgeries all the time for pitchers, Major League Baseball pitchers, for example, that seem to have, many of them seem to come out of it very, very well. But,
well, you know, one of the things you have to think about with those pitchers is, first of all, they have some of the very best care.
Yeah.
So they're caught immediately, and there's a large investment riding on them. So, and they need their shoulder for their vocation. So for the worker who also needs their shoulder for their vocation, then potentially surgery is the right answer for that person. And they can do well. You're right, Larry. Those people can do well. You know, even absent, you know, some of the best medical care and rehabilitation in the world. So you're absolutely right.
Claudia, I'm sorry. I was going to say Claudia in La Crosse has a question that relates to this. So I thought we'd just go to pop in with Claudia for a minute. Hi, Claudia.
Hi there. I'm calling because I've been dealing with shoulder problems for the last 5 years. I'm 68 now, and I was so disappointed. Let's say 5 years ago, I was having so much pain, like you said, especially at night. I got directed pretty much directly into the surgeons, and I've had 3 shoulder surgeries, and they failed. And so I'm really limited and doing a lot of different things to cope with that. I was so upset because I was a swimmer, kayaker, and cross-country skier. And my doctor said, well, you've just worn out your shoulders. I still do those things, though, in a different way. But talk about the acromion process. I think that's the name of a bone structure, and that there may be 3 different shapes, and it's a hereditary thing. And I'm trying to recall, I have one that leads to a lot of issues.
You probably have a type 3 Bigliani acromion.
Okay, and what the heck is that?
So Claudia, so that's a great, so this gets to kind of back to what Lori talked about, is that very, very small space between the top of your humerus and then kind of the roof, if you will, of your shoulder joint, your coracoacromial arch. And so depending on how you picked your parents, as you alluded to, Claudia, you can have a roof that kind of tips in, or the hook of your acromion, the distal end of your shoulder, can kind of fall in. And what that will do is really narrow that space that Lori was alluded to. So now you're already starting with a somewhat narrow space. You get a little bit of degenerative changes and inflammation in your bursa in an already narrowed space that becomes very challenging. So they may have done a Mumford procedure where they actually kind of resect the distal clavicle, and they'll go in and they'll shave off the undersurface of the acromion to try and make a little bit more space, or as we like to say, raise the roof. So is that something that you had done, Claudia?
Yes, I believe that was done, and some nodule arthritis that was in the shoulder, you know, kind of shaved off. And I think the first surgery, there was the torn tendons had to be kind of cut and evened out and sewn back together. But it was that then just one day just failed and tore, and my arm just dropped and it was severed.
Mm, Jill?
So we see that a lot, and then I'll let Lori jump in. Unfortunately, the failure rate of rotator cuff surgery, the range can be anywhere from 16 to 94%, depending on who you read. And so I think that's what Claudia experienced. So she had, it sounds like, a cleanup and then a rotator cuff repair, and then her cuff repair went on to subsequently fail. Does that sound
That sounds correct. And, you know, it's my understanding from some of the surgeons that at times repairing the rotator cuff is a little bit like sewing spaghetti back together. So depending upon the status of your rotator cuff when they went in there, you know, maybe they thought they could repair it, but it was just not repairable. I would hope that at the time they went in to repair that, that that's when they did that near Mumford procedure and they made more space for it, because if you're going to try to repair it, you sure as heck want to give it some room. Sometimes they'll do a bursectomy at the same time. They'll take out the subacromial bursa to again give more room. And they also have the long head of the biceps in there. I didn't know if you had a biceps tenotomy, or sometimes when you tear your rotator cuff, you also have a long head of the biceps problem. So that could have gone in there. So when they talk about arthritis, you know, Jill mentioned that space. You have that subacromial space. If you lose the tendon that occupies that space, what happens is the humeral head starts to move upward into that roof, and you lose that space between the ball and the roof, and then you develop pretty bad arthritis in your shoulder. So you want to try to save that space in your rotator cuff if you can, especially in someone who's only in her 60s.
So Claudia is in a situation here where things haven't worked. Are there physical therapy kinds of issues or things that she can do to maybe help her situation?
I would certainly try some good physical therapy, because the activities you described, Claudia, definitely we'd like to keep you as active as possible. Sometimes you can steal motion from other joints. In other words, make sure that your thoracic spine has really good mobility. Make sure that your scapula or shoulder blade moves appropriately, and see if getting some compensatory mobility in some of those other joints could be helpful. That would be my first line of defense.
That makes good sense. So the physical therapist is going to know the treatments to strengthen what you were talking about. Claudia, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jill Tine Nissenbaum, Lori Tine Brody, our guest today. You can join in with your question at 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at physical therapy issues today on the program with our two guests, Jill Tine Nissenbaum and Lori Tine Brody. We've zeroed in a bit on the rotator cuff, but we can take other questions as well, and I hope you join in. Helen in West Salem has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Helen. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. When I was 50, I fell off my bike and hit my tailbone. And I could not sit on a soft chair for a year because it had hurt so much. Well, then when I was 70, I was in a car accident and went to the hospital, and I wasn't really hurt. I knew that, but I was hurting. And so anyway, she took an X-ray of my neck area and back, and she said, "Oh, you've got scar tissue here. What happened?" Well, I realized it had to have been from that fall 20 years before. So now I'm 87. In the last few years, my back has bothered me. It always kind of hurt a little bit, but to the point where I really can't walk around a block, which I don't have to do. I mean, I can go up and down stairs, and I can do some gardening and whatever. But it's just that it hurts, and I take Tylenol, but I'm just wondering, is there any physical therapy that could help with this, or is this something I will live with?
And the scar, and is it the scar tissue? I was just going to ask that, Laura. Is it the scar tissue that may be causing the pain?
Oh, you're asking me? Hmm? So is the pain in your tailbone, or is it in your back?
This just in the back generally. I wouldn't
yeah,
say it's
yeah, you know,
tailbone is fine. I got a big lump there, but it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, at 87, one would expect some degenerative changes in your lumbar spine. If you have not had physical therapy, boy, there's so many things they could do to try to help you. You are so active now. You're gardening, you're doing stairs. There's no reason you can't be helped with a good assessment and finding areas that potentially need strengthening to help support your back or some mobility. Often we work on strengthening the areas around your hips and your lower abdominal muscles to help take some of the load off of your back while we're moving. Even people younger than you that I see who appear to be strong don't always use the muscles like they should when they're walking and so on. So sometimes just a couple of visits with a physical therapist can help retrain you to use those muscles to support your back while you're walking and doing activity. So I would absolutely encourage you to be seen and get some things to do to help, you know, prolong the amount of time that you're active. You know, you said you don't have to walk around the block, but geez, it'd sure be a good thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
So absolutely. I would absolutely do that.
Good luck, Helen. Thank you very much for calling. Well, Charlie and Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind? Charlie, are you there? No, oh, must have lost Charlie. Let's try Al, who's on the way to Iowa. Hi, Al.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
So I have a kind of a shoulder success story to share with you. I was listening on the road here. I tore my rotator cuff in November of 2000. Trying to lift a small refrigerator into the college size warm fridge in my garage. Do you know, describe it as white heat. You know, just trying to lift my arm, and it wouldn't work. So 2 months later, I had surgery, torn 3 out of the 4 major tendons in the shoulder. And did all the PT for 2 months just as instructed. And by about May of 2021, I was able to resume almost all of my activities. I did a lot of, home stretching and things like that that the doctors recommended. But I stuck with PT till about November of 2021. And then at that point, you know, I graduated. So the success part of it is I go kickboxing 3 days a week, and I also do strength training 3 days a week. And the only lingering effect so far is a little bit of tightness that I'm still struggling with. But my physical therapist has started to do dry needling on my shoulders, and that seems to loosen things up a little bit more. So I'm 46, and things seem to work really well. And that was one of those things, you know, it was pretty aggressive, but it had to get fixed.
Well, and Al, good for you, because you followed the directions of your doctors and your physical therapists. And I see Laurie and Jill both nodding in agreement to that.
Yeah, you know, Al is a perfect example of that young, active, working individual with a full thickness rotator cuff tear who needs surgery. So, you know, not all cases should be handled conservatively. Not all cases should be handled immediately with surgery. But if you have a young person with an acute tear who, you know, can't lift their arm, that's a surgical case. And you want to do it sooner rather than later before you get atrophy and retraction of that tendon that makes it harder to repair, which could have been the case with Claudia,
right.
And that her tendon was just not
of sufficient quality to affect a repair. But in Al's case, because it was acute and they got to it right away, they were able to restore the integrity of that tendon.
And the other thing you have to think about with someone who's younger is the integrity of the rest of their shoulder. So Al probably didn't have any wear and tear arthritis or a minimal amount of wear and tear arthritis. And we also hope that Al doesn't have a history of smoking or that he's a non-smoker, because we also know that that can impact tissue quality as well. So as Lori alluded to, younger, an acute tear of what we think is probably an otherwise healthy rotator cuff muscle that was successfully sewn back together with proper care and a compliant patient who now has a really good outcome.
Yeah. Al, thanks a lot. Appreciate that call very much. Mark in Rockton, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Your show is a treasure, as usual.
Thank you.
It's part of Wisconsin. And your expert today I've listened to, but I've never called in. Have you ever heard this? It didn't make sense to me, but the literature suggests that I had surgery, not orthopedic surgery. They gave me a Cipro, an antibiotic to prevent hospital-borne infections, I think. And there's some literature that suggests a relationship between tendonitis or even ruptured tendons. And I had a Achilles tendon rupture and surgically repaired over 20 years ago. So I'm kind of predisposed to this. And a couple weeks after this surgery, I have a couple arthritic knees, but all of a sudden, bang, both sides, I could not walk.
Oh.
And both my Achilles became really tight. So I'm interested if either of your guests have heard about this phenomenon, and if so, are there any? Does it resolve on its own, and are there any physical therapy approaches to kind of mitigate the damage?
Yeah,
boy, that's a great question, and I have heard of this. A susceptibility to rupture. And when you said Achilles, that was the first tendon that came to mind. I expect that would be the very first one to go. In terms of physical therapy to mitigate that, I would just say using caution in terms of your activity. So, you know, depending upon what you had surgery for, if I was going to go out and, you know, be active, go on a hike, you know, I would watch things that stress my Achilles tendon. Like I wouldn't be doing a lot of, I certainly wouldn't jog. And I would not be doing any walking on hills where you stress the Achilles going up and going down. I would be trying to minimize activities that put my tendons at risk. I expect that when the medication clears your system, that there's no long-lasting effects, but I can't say I know that for sure. I have not investigated the literature on that, but it sounds like you have. Have you found anything out?
I haven't dug far enough to know what the outcomes are, but it's a few weeks out, and my knees are still not very operative, and I can't walk great distances. It's better than it was. I couldn't walk at all, and
so when
my Achilles are not quite as tight as they were.
So when you say you can't walk, is it because of pain? Is it because of weakness? What is the cause of not being able to walk?
Acute pain.
Acute pain.
Both knees went from being, you know, just mildly uncomfortable for a number of years to bang, you know, just.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Much inoperative.
That's. I'm gonna check that out. I'm gonna find an answer to that question, or find out what the evidence says about the question. I don't know. Does the literature ever really have an answer? I'm not sure. So, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Great, great and interesting concept here. So, and maybe who knows if we have some listeners that know more about this, they may chime in, but it's an important question.
Yeah, Mark.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mark, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Arlene in New Berlin, we'll go to you next. Hi, Arlene.
Good morning, and thank you for your the guests you have on. I've called in before.
Oh, I think we lost Arlene. Oh, she has a shoulder problem and wondering about an exercise she can do. Maybe she'll call back and we'll get that We'll let her call back again. Jeff in Rock County, let's go to you. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I was diagnosed with a shoulder impingement, and I was wondering, you know, I went to the dangerous place of the internet and, you know, found The Hang. What do you think about that, where you use your body weight to try to...
We had someone call in about this before. So I believe you just suspend your body weight from your arms overhead. Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, you just hang.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I would be against it for many, many reasons, of which I'll list a few. Number one, if you have an impingement or that pinch with overhead activity, it sounds to me like putting your arm overhead and then putting all your body weight on it would just be really counterintuitive. So that's part of it. Number two, there's probably a mechanical reason that this is happening and something that a physical therapist can probably address to help you not pinch in that space. Number three, it sounds risky that you could be at risk of dislocating a shoulder if you're hypermobile, and I'll stop there.
I'll chime in on that. So, you know, I've been at this job long enough to have like fallen on the sword on certain issues and then later regretted it. So I always ask myself, well, if someone is suggesting this, is there something that I'm missing about what's going on? So I'm going to start by saying that potentially there is a segment, a subgroup of people who do well with this activity. And maybe it's people who have tightness in their shoulder joint capsule, and by hanging, they get a really good capsular stretch that then subsequently increases that space that Jill and I talked about, that space between the ball and the roof. So there may be a small group of people that works for, and they might be people who are genetically tight as compared to what Jill mentioned, the people who are hypermobile, where this would be terrible for them. So is it good or bad? It depends. So there may be a group that it works for, but for the average person, if I had to say, I would say I wouldn't do it without a good assessment first.
Yeah, there you go, Jeff. Thank you.
How's that for a middle child answer?
There you go.
Perfect.
Oh, man. I think Arlene from New Berlin is back. Arlene, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yes, there was just a glitch in the phone. The reason I'm calling is I can't remember if anything really happened and I did not fall. I go and shop, I get my own groceries, or, you know, I do things that I can physically do. By the way, I'm 82 years old. So now that I'm looking at my shoulder in the mirror, I have a lump on top of the shoulder. And I do know that it's a rotator cuff tear. I talked to the doctor, she got the x-ray and everything, and she said, yes, you have rotator cuff, but my arm does not hurt me. I have arthritis. I see an arthritic doctor once a year. But I don't know if I should do an exercise to help, because I can raise my arm up. I can put my arm out to the, raise it sideways. I can raise it back. I can raise it forward. But it doesn't hurt. And is there any other exercise I should do to help, strengthen it? At 82, I don't know if I want to have surgery.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, if you have no pain, Arlene, there's absolutely no reason to have surgery. It sounds to me like you're functioning very well. You can lift your arm up and you're mobile. You would fit in that population that has a rotator cuff tear, but has adapted or accommodated and is functioning beautifully. So for an 82-year-old person, I would not recommend surgery for somebody who has no pain. So you mentioned strengthening or what should I or could I do? I think the best thing for you to do is to keep that mobility, keep taking your arms up and overhead, don't be hesitant to use your arm to do things, and keep kind of functioning at the level you are. Lori, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So why did they take an x-ray and investigate your shoulder if you were not having any pain and had full function?
Because at the time I did have some pain. Sometimes when I go grocery shopping, I buy those big packets of water. But when I leave the grocery store, I have somebody put them in my car, and I usually generally wait for my son to come home and, take it out of the car. Every once in a while, I have to carry something a little bit heavy, and it's in the initial problem, it did hurt. But then I said to myself, listen, this is ridiculous. You can't be lifting 50 to 100-pound things that I need to move. Yeah, so I just want to make sure that I'm not going to do anything to jeopardize, my shoulder.
Well, you're not, as long as you continue to use good judgment. So if you say, gol darn it, I want that 50-pound bag of water softener salt out of my car right now, and I'm going to do it myself, you're going to be in trouble. Because if you do have arthritis there and you overdo it, then you are going to flare that shoulder up. So just continue to use it. As Jill said, use it for your daily activities, but also continue to use that wisdom of 82 years, okay?
Yeah, sound like a pretty sharp gal, Arlene.
Indeed.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Harry, by the way, you can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly here. Harry emailed ideas@WPR.org, and he has a frequent nagging pain in both shoulders, aggravated by driving a tractor without power steering. I remember those days. It's not fun. He regularly has night pain, which is often accompanied by numbness in both hands. He has carpal tunnel syndrome, but this numbness occurs even when he keeps his wrists straight or if he wears wrist braces. Wonders if you have any suggestions.
It sounds to me like that's probably coming from Harry's neck. Anytime we hear something that is bilateral, we think about going to the cervical spine for that. Driving a tractor that's what, Larry, not power steering, is that what he said?
Yeah, they're hard to drive.
So I'm guessing there's a lot of gripping and vibration with that.
And hard turning.
And hard turning.
At the end of the field.
That sounds like the voice of experience.
Right, exactly. That's what I was going to say. So those things could be bothering Harry's shoulders for sure, but I'm wondering if it's neck position, especially when you talked about numbness and tingling in both hands, irrespective of whether he's wearing his carpal tunnel braces or not. That sounds to me like maybe some sort of foraminal narrowing or central stenosis in his cervical spine. So seeing a physical therapist would help, because they could give him appropriate exercises, stretching and mobility to do to address his neck, which I think would probably help with his shoulder pain.
Yeah, totally agree. It sounds very neck-like.
Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody, our guests today. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW. Lori, physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at physical therapy issues today with our two guests, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Great to have them with us today. Virginia and DeForest has a question, so let's go there next. Hi, Virginia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
My 84-year-old husband walks about 3.5 to 4 miles every single day. He's having some discomfort with his foot, where the top of the foot meets the toes, and he's feeling tingling and like electrical impulses. He's seen a doctor, and we think that it's some kind of neuropathy, but they don't want to be doing anything until they do more testing, and that's not till September. Is there some kind of physical therapy that he could be doing that might help with that?
Yeah, so they're probably trying to sort out if it's an idiopathic neuropathy, that is a neuropathy with unknown cause, which tends to happen. Is it just in one foot or both?
Just in one foot at this time.
So you could also, it could also be a Morton's neuroma. So I don't know if they have ruled that out. But that would be, I would want to rule that out before I did a whole bunch of like EMG, sticking him with needles kind of a thing, to see if it's a peripheral neuropathy. So depending upon, it might be a question for the physician first of, could this be a Morton's neuroma? And the physician may say, I checked for that and I don't think that's what it is. And that's fine. Or, you know, sometimes a primary care physician, it's not their area of expertise. So you could check in with a podiatrist who might be able to screen for that, or someone who specializes in foot and ankle. So we can start with what's the cause of it. The next question is it limiting his ability to walk that 3 to 4 miles per day?
No, it's not. What he's finding is that when he goes to bed at night, it starts to those electrical impulses are keeping him awake. We have found that if we put pressure on it and use like a elastic bandage or something and bandage it really tight and keep pressure on it, that stops.
Okay, well, you can continue with those things. You can certainly make an appointment with a physical therapist and have them do an examination, because it's going to be a while until other things are sorted out. The pressure, if you put pressure sort of on the bottom of your foot to spread the area between your toes, that would relieve a Morton's neuroma. Sort of squeezing the ball of your foot together theoretically should make it worse. So that being said, it's hard to know if that wrap tells us anything additional about the cause. So certainly seeing a physical therapist, if it's not limiting his ability to walk, I would certainly have him continue walking as long as it's not making it worse. I would want to make sure it's not changing how he walks, if he's having pain when he's walking, because then the next thing is you're gonna hurt you're gonna have a balance issue, you're gonna have a knee issue, you're gonna have a hip back issue. So perhaps seeing a physical therapist to assess his gait, to look at the foot and see if there's any other suggestions they might have. One or two visits, I think, certainly would be helpful. But in the absence of knowing the underlying cause, it's a little hard to give a recommendation about A, B, or C.
I was just talking with a friend on Saturday who is about 50 years old and having some problems. And the physical, went in for some, to the physical therapist. And here she finds out that one leg's a half inch shorter than the other, or a little bit more than a half inch shorter, and fitted her with something in her inside her shoe, and it took away the problem.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that have a leg length discrepancy, and then you want to make sure that it's structural and not functional. And I'm sure the physical therapist did that. And then you can correct for that. And typically we only correct for about 50% of the discrepancy, because you don't need to be perfectly even, Steve. Right. And we all have a little side to side difference. But absolutely, that's definitely something to consider as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thanks, Larry.
Virginia, good luck. Thank you for calling. Just had that conversation a day or two ago, which is why it was still in my head. Let's go to Leslie in Milwaukee. Hi, Leslie.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
So my question is, I was born with hip dysplasia, and I'm 56. And it's, I'd say the last 10 years, it's gotten progressively worse. A lot of stiffness and pain. I've tried physical therapy for so many years, and it really doesn't help me. The only thing that has relieved my pain and has made me feel so really good is a cortisone shot. And it's been effective, but the last one I got only worked for 2 months, and then it wore out. And So that's like my pattern. It's not lasting long. So I am scheduled to have a hip replacement, but it's hard to think about getting a hip replacement when I know, like at this moment, my hip is feeling good and I know it's from the cortisone shot. So I feel like, should I keep living with these, you know, cortisone shots? I feel like it's just a Band-Aid and I don't really like it. And the last one hurt me a lot and it was very expensive. And so I guess I just wanted your input, the guest's input on, you know, am I doing the right thing? As I know, you know, as far as getting a hip replacement with my situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are great questions, and that's a very extensive medical history. So congenital hip dysplasia, you've you know, picked your parents with some bony changes, unfortunately. Lots of rehab, and now it sounds to me like the conservative management of the cortisone injection, which is, you know, has risks as well, is kind of starting to wear off and deteriorate, and you're not getting the benefits you did. So in my mind, I think it's time to consider a total hip replacement. I agree with you. It sounds like you've exhausted everything. You've done a really good job at looking into all of the conservative care. So I would definitely say the pendulum is swinging towards a total hip replacement for you. And just know that the outcomes of a total hip replacement for those individuals who are compliant postoperatively, et cetera, are really good. So I would not consider a total hip replacement the old people surgery anymore. I think we have lots of really good outcomes with it. The life expectancy of the prosthesis is very good now. They're lasting a lot longer. So me personally, it sounds like this is probably your right choice, Lori.
Yeah, I totally agree. And a couple things about that. One is, you know, you say your hip is feeling good. One of the things I tell my patients who are preparing for surgery, like a knee replacement or hip replacement would be the two classic things I see people for, are you want to take really good care of that joint up to surgery. So the attitude of, oh, I'm going to have a joint replacement in a couple weeks, I can just go do anything I want to do, bad idea. You want that joint to be as calm and the inflammation as low as possible before surgery. It's going to have a better outcome. If you go into surgery with an inflamed and irritated joint, you are likely to have a poor outcome. You're going to have inflammation upon inflammation, and you're going to have pain, fibrosis, and so on. So you really want that hip to feel almost like, gee, I wonder if I should have surgery. I'm feeling pretty good. So your statement about I'm feeling pretty good, should I have surgery? That's right where you want to be before surgery. The second thing, back to Larry's comment about leg length differences, is you will often see a leg length difference after surgery, after a hip replacement, because the surgeons sort of intentionally make that leg a little bit longer. So you may notice a difference after surgery. And so you need to talk with your physical therapist about whether or not that is causing some other symptoms for you.
Good luck with that, Leslie. Thank you so much for calling. Keith and Racine, let's go to you next. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just calling to share a little story and the need for a second opinion. I was in Florida a couple years ago and was experiencing some severe left shoulder pain. And, you know, find a surgeon, and he said, yeah, I can fix it. But he really didn't say it had to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, it didn't. When I came back to Wisconsin and I saw another orthopedic surgeon up here, and he had his PA and him, you know, manipulate my shoulders, and I had plenty of range of motion and no pain. He said, you don't need anything. Lots of details I could go into, but the point of the story is you need to get a second opinion, because some surgeons see a torn rotator cuff as a source of income, and others see it as a one-off consultation. And that's what I had here in Wisconsin. It was a wonderful experience.
Hmm.
Well, I'm glad to hear you had a good experience here. That's really good. And you're right. Just because something should be fixed doesn't mean, or can be fixed doesn't mean it should be fixed. And now, interestingly, more and more physicians and physician groups are looking at their outcomes to look at, to make sure that their surgeries are successful. So they're considering more, you want to know those outcomes of your surgeon. You want to know how much people improved from pre-surgery to post-surgery and things like that. So patient selection becomes very important for them. They want to make sure that they're, the people that they're choosing to operate on are those that truly need it. And so we see a lot more of that, I think, as of late. But thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah. Keith, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. And Bruce in Kenosha, we'll be getting to you, but just a reminder here, we're talking physical therapy issues with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program, and Lori Tyne-Brody, Physical Therapist and an Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back to take Bruce's question and maybe your question as well, so give a call. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at physical therapy with our regular guests, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It's great to have them with us today. Lori's with the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Our lines are filled, so we'll go right to the phones. And Bruce has been patiently awaiting in Kenosha County, so let's go to Bruce. Thank you for waiting.
Hello, Larry. My question is about I had total knee replacement in December, and the physical therapy and everything went really well. I'm now walking 9 holes of golf, just finished a round this morning.
Good for you.
Shot a 61. I'm getting there.
Yeah.
But it's so where I do this leg lift, you lay on your side and you lift your leg, and it exercises that big muscle on the side. What is it, a plank? And that's fine. And they had me do that. I can do that all day long. But if I bend my knee and then try to lift my leg, it hurts like the dickens. What's going on there?
Hurts your knee?
Yeah, it hurts right at the knee and kind of in the shin.
So you bend your knee and then lift your leg?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I can do that with my other leg. Fine.
It's something to do with the mechanics of the knee replacement. And when you lie on your side and you lift, when your knee is straight, your knee joint itself is kind of locked, where the femur, the round ball, and the tibia are kind of locked together really snug. But when you bend your knee, they're no longer locked in that position, and you can get traction across the outside of your knee because the bony structure is not stable and snug. So when you start to bend your knee, you get a little bit of side-to-side instability.
Yeah.
So then when you lift your leg, the weight of the traction of your lower leg is torquing across your knee. So the bottom line is, as I like to say, oh, it hurts,
don't do it.
Keep your darn knee straight. So, yeah. But mechanically, for those of you who are inclined into mechanics and physics, that's probably what's happening.
So
it's explainable. Does that make you feel better?
Right. Yeah. Right. So it's explainable. And again, the intent of that exercise, you laying on your side and lifting your leg, is to strengthen one of your hip stabilizers, your gluteus medius. And so actually doing it with your leg straight is actually harder. So more power to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And good luck with the golf, Bruce. Thanks a lot for calling.
We're all envious of your golfing 9 holes this morning.
Diane in Jefferson, on to you. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I had a total rotator cuff tear many years ago, and they put screws in to hold it together and everything. And now in October, I had my shoulder replaced. Mm-hmm. And it is so much pain yet, and I just don't have the range of motion, which I know they told me I wouldn't, but I still can't reach under my armpit. And I'm wondering, how do they connect a tore-up rotator cuff to this bone, to the artificial bone? And I did have the reverse one done.
Oh, you did. So you don't need a rotator cuff if you have a reverse total shoulder. So that was going to be my next question. So typically people who have massive, what we call cuff tear arthropathy, or a massive kind of degenerative rotator cuff, if you're going to have a total shoulder replacement, most people do have what we call the reverse total shoulder. And what they do is they make the ball flat or flatter, and they make the your glenoid or your shoulder blade round. And so they do the opposite. They flip-flop them. Thank you, Lori, for that advanced medical term. but the take-home message is you don't need a rotator cuff to lift your arm overhead anymore. You should be deltoid dominant. So it's a little unusual for you to not have your motion back yet. Most people, barring any little hiccups, would have okay motion, depending on how extensive or what level of function you were at prior to your reverse total shoulder. Lori has something to say.
Well, I was going to ask you, do they have full range of motion? I know with the not reverse, with the regular, it is not expected that you will get full motion back. So what would be full motion in a reverse shoulder?
Are you asking me?
I'm asking you.
150s, 160s. Okay. But what Diane is talking about is reaching across and getting at her other armpit. Is that right, Diane?
Right. Yeah. And I can't hold anything out real heavy anymore yet either. I mean, I'm working on it, but it still feels like it's falling out of the socket. And obviously it's not.
So does it feel, let me ask you this. Does it feel, do you have motion and it just feels weak yet, or are you having a hard time with your motion? Because those are two different things.
Hard time with motion. I think the pain in the muscles the range of motion is a lot of pain.
Okay. Are you still seeing physical therapy?
No. My insurance will not allow me anymore.
So I'm
back to work. Well, I drive dump truck, and I think the steering wheel is making it worse.
So let's just back up. So you've had the shoulder surgery, you had physical therapy for your shoulder post-op. Mm-hmm. You can go back with a new problem, and it could be shoulder pain. It could be shoulder weakness. It could be shoulder loss of motion. This is no longer attached to your previous plan of care for your shoulder surgery. This is considered a new problem. So I would campaign to go back to physical therapy, because you're not going to be able to do your job driving a dump truck if you continue to have this loss of motion and weakness. It will begin to impair your function. So I would go back and request a new referral to physical therapy for shoulder pain, shoulder weakness. You can label it whatever you want, but it's a new plan of care. It is no longer post-operative shoulder care.
And do that. Mm-hmm. Please do that.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Okay, yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much. Carol in Schofield, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I am scheduled for a hip replacement, and it's going to be a posterior approach as opposed to the anterior. And I am getting physical therapy up to the point of the surgery. But I've heard a lot of information about the anterior approach being better than the posterior approach. And I'm wondering if the physical therapists have seen patients after one or the other and would have an opinion about the recovery time and the ability to do what you'd like to do after the surgery.
That's a great question. And each one has its advantages and disadvantages. And of course, my first question would be to the surgeon is which one do you do and what's your history of it? What are your outcomes? Things like that. The posterolateral approach is the more classic approach. That's the traditionally total hip replacement. It comes with those precautions that we all know of not flexing and crossing our leg, things like that. Many people's concern is because you have to cut through the gluteus medius muscle to get to it, which is one of the big key hip stabilizers that's a downside of it. As long as you have really good strengthening postoperatively, I think it's totally fine. The anterior approach, I know one of the precautions or the restrictions is you have to limit hip extension. And what happens with a lot of people with that is they end up getting really tight in their hip flexors. They end up with some low back pain. Not everybody, but that's kind of one of the downsides of that surgery. So I don't know that there's the overall outcomes of one being better than the other. But those are the things you have to consider is just knowing firsthand what kind of you're going into and make sure that your physical therapist has a good understanding of that. And since you're already having care now, that's a really good strategy. And then my big thing is I would never want to be, oh, this is the first time I've done this for a surgeon. I would like to be the 10,000th total hip replacement with a posterolateral approach, not the first. Lori has something to say.
Right. So typically, surgeons are trained in a specific technique. They get trained from wherever they did their residency and fellowship. And so they get better at one or another. So as Jill said, I would want to have the surgery that surgeon is best at and most comfortable with. If you are going to continue with the posterolateral, and I see these patients every day, work really hard on those glutes now so that post-op, you remember how they work. So one of the biggest problems we see with cutting through that gluteal muscle is that patients don't remember how to fire that muscle. Like they can't see it, they can't feel it. It's now been cut through in surgery and they just can't fire it. So make sure you're working with your PT now to really get good at firing that and knowing what that feels like so you can get it back post-op.
Good luck, Carol. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Andy in Cudahy, your turn now. Hi, Andy.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Past history, 45-year-old, had a meniscus tear of the right knee. It was scraped at that time. 25 years later, still doing my gardening. I've been noticing more pain now because of the kneeling. I was wondering, glucosamine has been around for many decades already. Is oral glucosamine of any value for reducing knee pain, or does your digestive tract break it down? Second question is, how does synovial fluid get in and out of your knee if there's no blood vessels?
I'll start with the second one.
Okay, so Andy's done his research on the internet, hasn't he?
He has, Dr. Google. So let me just start by saying pain with kneeling on your knee, that's probably a separate issue from the meniscus. The meniscus is typically a weight-bearing thing. The kneeling on your knee is potentially patellofemoral. So Jill's going to say something. She took a deep breath.
Well, yes to kneeling unless he kind of sits back on his heels.
Right, and is in full flexion. Yeah, that's possible. So the synovial fluid is super important for the nutrition of your knee. So you're right that the interior of your meniscus does not have a blood supply, but the periphery does. The synovial fluid is critical because that's the only source of nutrition for your articular cartilage in an adult. So it is there. And then Jill's going to take the glucosamine question.
Yes, glucosamine many times combined with chondroitin. So that combination. So the pendulum has swung back and forth for quite some time on whether this is effective or not in people with arthritic changes in their joints. And most recently, most of the literature has swung towards the direction of it is not effective. But I'm going to, of course, as Lori said, you always got to put a little asterisk sign with that. So the challenge with providing good evidence regarding whether glucosamine with or without chondroitin is helpful is this. They're not FDA regulated. And so when we try to do a study on that, maybe the combination of glucosamine and chondroitin in the sample that was used in the study is different from the one on the shelf, and therefore things may be different. The other thing is many times when people start taking glucosamine and chondroitin, they do it concurrently with a weight loss program or an exercise program or a leg strengthening program or something like that. And so is it truly the glucosamine and chondroitin that's making a difference, or is it these other things that we're doing in combination with it? So what I will tell you is there's not compelling literature to support the use of glucosamine and chondroitin. And the minute I say that, a whole bunch of people line up and say to me, Jill, I've been taking it for years and it makes a huge difference. And my response is, okay, good. Good for you. If you're going to try it, Andy, the one thing I always tell people is, number one, it takes about 3 months before you'll see a response. And number two, please check with your physician or pharmacist to make sure that it's not going to negatively impact any prescription medications you may take.
Good luck,
that was
Andy.
Great. That was perfect, Jill. Thanks, Lori. That's spot on.
And thank you, Andy, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Let's go to Kevin in Buffalo or Bullfrog Springs.
Hi. About 10 years ago, I had a really sore right shoulder, and I couldn't sleep at all. I couldn't lay down. I couldn't hardly do anything. And for days, it was just completely wrecking me. Chiropractors worked on it for a while, says, oh, you probably need surgery on your rotator cuff. So I got an MRI, and the doctor looked at it, and he said, yeah, could use surgery. But he suggested that it was painful because of I'm older now, like it was around 60, and it was just loose muscles. And so I started walking about 4 miles a day and carrying 2-3 pound weights with me and just doing, at first, the only thing I could do was a simple curl up. Then pretty soon I could, by the end of the walk, I could, you know, lift all range of motion. I could move my arms up and force it through. And after about 4 days, my shoulder got better, and it's been fine since.
I love that story. So from the people who like the mechanical side of it, the supraspinatus, as Jill mentioned at the top of the show, one of the main rotator cuff muscles, one of the things it does is she said it seats the humeral head on the, or the golf ball on the tee, so to speak. When your arm is hanging down by your side, that traction, the rotator, that supraspinatus is working to resist that traction. So if you have a weight in your hand and you're walking, that supraspinatus is working to hold that weight up. So it's a fine exercise for your rotator cuff if you can handle it. So your shoulder responded to that activity very nicely. And I don't know what you did to flare it up in the first place, but strengthening your rotator cuff, which is fundamentally what you did, was the answer to your problem. And that's what we do in physical therapy, is we find ways to strengthen your rotator cuff that you can manage. Not everybody's going to be able to walk with weights in their hands, in which case the physical therapist would find other ways to strengthen your supraspinatus for you. There's a lot of ways to manage that issue, but well done.
Yeah, well done indeed. Kevin, thank you so much. Well, a listener emailed wondering if you could speak about the effects of cool laser therapy. And is this something that can be done at home with home electronics?
So cold lasers are a class 4 laser, I believe. And they're kind of a red light kind of thing where you use laser. To the best of my knowledge, I don't think there's anything that you could use at home that would use the same
frequency.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. to create that. So there are portable electrical stimulation units you can use at home to alleviate pain, to gate pain. Those would be operating on a different intent. But they're both typically used to alleviate pain.
Do they work?
That would not be my first go-to for shoulder pain. at all. Right. Lots of other options. Typically in physical therapy, we might use a modality, and that's what laser is considered. Ultrasound, laser, electrical stim, those are what we call physical therapy modalities. They might be used as an adjunct to our treatment program, our plan of care, but for the most part, the primary components of our plan of care would consist of manual therapy and or therapeutic exercise.
We've been talking a lot about shoulders, and Lynn in Oshkosh emailed to ask, hey, is total shoulder replacement even done much nowadays?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we had that conversation earlier with Diane. So we don't see as much arthritis in the shoulder as we do in the lower extremity, the hip and knee, for example, because for most people, the shoulder is a non-weight bearing joint. So we're not putting a ton of load in it. Having said that, there are people whose jobs, activities, et cetera, do require a lot of load through their joint, or they get wear and tear arthritis. So there was a traditional total shoulder replacement, but the pendulum is really starting to swing to the reverse total shoulder, which is what Diane had done, where they reverse the ball and socket concept. And with that, you do not have any, there's no need for a rotator cuff. And so with all this talk that we've had these last 90 minutes about rotator cuff arthritis and rotator cuff arthropathy and rotator cuff tears, you can see how the creation of a prosthesis where you could have a good outcome and not need a rotator cuff is really important. So there's some really good, compelling studies looking at really good outcomes with the reverse total shoulder replacement.
Right. And in terms of arthritis in your shoulder, I mean, yes, perhaps people who work overhead, but I would say by far and away, the people who end up needing a total shoulder because of arthritis in their shoulder, it's because they lack a rotator cuff, because the rotator cuff is gone, not occupying that space. The humeral head slides up into the roof overhead, and that bone, it's basically bone on bone in your shoulder. And that's what results in the need for the shoulder replacement. So thus, as Jill said, using a prosthesis that does not require a rotator cuff would be the key.
You know, we had lots of great questions today, and you two had, as usual, a lot of great answers.
Thanks, Larry.
It was fun, and you guys will be back June 20th.
All right. Awesome. Sounds great.
And we will do this all over again. Thank you both so much. Really appreciate
your
time.
Thanks, Larry. Bye, everyone.
See ya. Have a great week.
Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW-Madison. One of our guests, the other, Lori Tyne-Brody, Physical Therapist and an Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And they'll be back on June 20th. And some of you who called today may be able to call back on June 20th and tell us how you did, which is always a lot of fun. Just looking ahead to tomorrow, we'll talk first about how much water you really need to stay hydrated. So that's one topic. But then we'll switch at 11:45 and talk with a dentist. And we'll zero in on adult dentistry issues at 11:45. All on Tuesday, right here on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller.